This is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, November 24th, 2011. Happy Thanksgiving. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Ithi Agnihotri Mudholkar. On this edition of Ozarks at Large, another visit from author Bill Walker, who discusses his father's story in his book, Nazi's Nightmare.
We'll also have a conversation with Michael Tilley, a usual Thursday item from our content partner, thecitywire.com. That's coming up in just a bit.
Support for KUAF is provided by the Malco Cinema Razorback Theater, featuring the Met Opera live in HD, presenting Rodelinda on Saturday, December 3rd at 11:30 a.m. Tickets and more information are available on the web at malco.com.
We'll begin this Thanksgiving edition of Ozarks at Large with author Colin Bevan. Earlier this fall, Colin Bevan, also known as the No Impact Man, was in Fayetteville for the One Book, One Community Project sponsored by the University of Arkansas. That book, of course, No Impact Man. While here, he also attended several other events in the community, including the 8th annual Gathering of the Groups at the Fayetteville Public Library. He was the featured speaker. I sat down to talk with him in front of 8 different local book clubs.
When I wrote the book in 2000, when I first conceived of the book at the end of 2006, I say it in the book, like, you know, I was upset about the world, and what I did about it was I complained about it to the elevator operator in my building, you know. And you know, what a lot of us do as Americans, I shouted at the television. Or in modern times, I, you know, left comments on the Huffington Post, you know, which is interesting because all of these things kind of expend our energy, but they don't actually do much. I've come to think that, you know, there's nothing more depressing than feeling like you're a victim. And I think many of us feel like we're victims of world circumstances. One of the big lessons that I learned through No Impact Man is that, first of all, we are hugely powerful. And we can talk more about that and why I think so, but each of us are gigantically powerful. We have the power to help our communities, and by community I mean our block, our town, our state, our country, and our world. And the thing about it is that when you exercise that power, it feels better. It feels better than feeling like you're a victim of what's going on in the world. And so this word responsibility, I always think, I'm not a big fan of that word. I haven't been a big fan of it since my mother and my grandfather told me to have more of it when I didn't make my bed, you know. But if we turn it around and say, call responsibility the ability to respond, and to say to ourselves that we all have the ability to respond, that actually is amazing once we are able to own that and say that actually I do have a part to play in what's happening in the world.
And you take on so many different issues, including the desire to have more things, the message to us that we should have more things because this doesn't work or this doesn't look good. And there are different indexes about countries that are happiest, and it's almost inverse to the amount of things we get. And you ask yourself and you ask the reader in the book, when are we fulfilled? And that's a question that runs through the book.
Sure. And so another way to put it is, what are we using the resources for? You know, I often say, if we're going to wreck the place, we ought to be having a party doing it, you know. When you wake up on Sunday morning and your house is filled with cigarette butts and beer cans, if you didn't have fun on the Saturday night, what's the point of having to clean up? You know, so that's the real question. I don't think, you know, sometimes people, I've had people come to me and they say, you know, I buy everything secondhand. I bought my shoes secondhand, but I can't find a place to buy my shoelaces secondhand. You know, so like we get really obsessed with reducing our negative impact. I think that the logical conclusion of that, that our goal is to have no impact, the logical conclusion is commit suicide, right? So it begs a big point. Like, the real question is not, I mean, the question, of course, is that we're efficient in our use of resources, but the real question is, what are we using our resources for? You know, both, you know, are we using our resources to actually make ourselves and our communities happier? Or are we stuck in some sort of treadmill where we're using like gigantic amount of resources, but it's not really working for anything? Because if you're lucky enough to have the money to buy a pair of jet skis, for example, what are they doing for 51 weeks of the year? They're sitting in our garages. And so the question is, what can we do for ourselves that actually improve our lives and improves the planet? And just to say one last thing, our very lives are a resource, you know? And the question becomes, what are we using that precious resource for? Because if we're not using the precious resource, which is our own life, in line with our purpose for actually walking here on this planet, then it really truly is a waste of resources.
And you write that the average American needs 8 weeks to pay for their car and car-related items.
Right. And so, you know, sometimes when I travel and give talks, people say, oh, people like you, you just want to take away our cars. And I always say to them, no, really, I'm not about trying to force my ideas down your throat. But I'm about, like, helping, you know, just making sure that everything is clear. You know, so we spend 8 weeks, you know, paying for our cars. And then, you know, the average American spends 72 minutes a day alone in their car. If you start to add up how much time we spend paying for our car or alone in our car, it comes out to 4 work months. And so the question is not, you know, that someone like me wants to take everybody's cars away. The question is whether our culture is, whether our transportation system is designed in a way that actually makes us happy. Like, what would happen if we actually designed, and what would happen if we had land use, if we designed ourselves not all spread out in suburbs, but where we could actually walk to the post office and pet our neighbor's dog and see our school friend on the street corner on the way? You know, Kurt Vonnegut, he's my favorite author, and one time he was getting himself ready to go to the post office, and he would go to the post office and stand in line and buy some stamps and, you know, then trundle on home. And his wife said to him, said, why don't you just use a fax machine? We live a modern way. He said, the purpose of life is to futz around and don't ever forget it.
He said you and some of your friends rediscovered charades. Once the TV was gone, discovered interaction.
Right. So, I mean, and I often say, you know, people say, are you against progress? And I'm like, no, of course I'm not against progress. I just question whether a society that plays less charades than it used to is actually progressing. So, you know, so and the idea that we could get together and talk and play as friends. What's happened? I mean, we have to get it. First of all, you know, it's very typical in the environmental movement to kind of wear the horsehair shirt, like think we're doing penance for being human, like human beings are bad. And so I really want to make sure that this conversation is not about how we're bad and we have to get good. Actually, what happened was we evolved a way of life that where we pulled ourselves up by our own bootstraps. It's not to say, we're not bad, and it's just that circumstances have changed, you know? It's just like in the winter, you wear a sweater. Well, when the spring comes and it starts to get hot, it doesn't make the sweater bad. It's just that the circumstances have changed. It's time to take the sweater off. So, you know, the way that we've been is fine. It's just that it turns, you know, there's so many more people on the planet. You know, it's we can't all have the same the amount of stuff that we have. We have, because there's so many more people, the resources are stretched much more thinly, so we have to work much harder for the same amount of things. So the question becomes, and for a long time, earning money, having a system, you know, where we measured our well-being according to our GDP, according to our economy, for a long time, that actually was a good measure, right? That you could say that because we were getting to the, because it turned out we had more well-being when we had more money. But now it turns out that those, you know, money going through the system and human well-being are kind of on different paths. So how do we start to ask ourselves, you know, I have no idea what your question was, but I'm like...
It was charades. You're so excited about charades.
Yeah. And then you asked me about charades, and I'm talking about the GDP. Yeah, I don't know. So that's why I don't need TV, because I can just talk and talk and talk.
At the beginning of this process, when you were talking, I think it was with your agent, about this project, and someone had said, you know, you need to do more to affect change than just change light bulbs. You need to change your senator. And you've said that's not enough. There has to be massive citizen participation.
Yeah, I mean, what happened? That story is to me, that in many ways, that the story that you mentioned is a coming-of-age story to me, because what happened was, you know, I decided to embark on this project, and you know, an author hopes that when their book comes out, they'll get some publicity. And it never occurs to an author that they're going to get crazy publicity while they're still writing the book. And that's what happened to me. And all of a sudden, you know, I was before these TV cameras, and people were asking me, like, really deep and profound, you know, what do we do to save the world? And I'm like, ah, all I do is sit in my underwear on the couch all day and type. Why are you asking me? You know. So I was really scared, and I guess I had at that time an over-inflated sense of myself, and I thought that, you know, what I said, you know, mattered, and so I was scared, so I called up somebody, a senior member of the environmental movement, and I said, what do I say? And he said, you know, tell them it's not enough to change our light bulbs, we have to change our senators. And I thought about that for a while. I thought, that's true, but it's not my message. And finally, I started actually having to go before the cameras and say actually what I thought. And that's why it was a coming-of-age story. Like, I actually found myself having to publicly be myself, you know, publicly accept that this is who I was and this is what I thought. And then I realized that actually my message is not so it's not so radical. My message is simply the world has really big problems. We are in the habit of outsourcing the problems to other people and waiting for them to solve them. That's not working. We need to really get involved. It's not such a radical message, actually. But it took me a while before I realized that. And part of it has to do with changing our senators. That doesn't mean it actually doesn't necessarily mean changing the person of our senators. It means changing the person within our senators. Like, if you vote Republican, that's fine. Actually, if you vote Republican, in some ways, from my point of view, that's, I happen to vote the other way, but I don't care. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't, you know, I think we need to talk. So this is not a big, gigantic division, right? Thank you. You know, so it just happens to be one way. But if you're a Republican, then I hope that you will let your Republican senator or congressperson or city councilor know that you care about this stuff, that you're their supporter and you want them to take care of this habitat that we care about.
Are you ever concerned about what people might think when they meet you? In other words, this morning I was getting ready, and I knew I was going to be here, and I looked, okay, my only pair of dark shoes, they're about 5 years old. I feel good about wearing those in front of Colin. This suit was bought new. I should probably walk to work today. Are you concerned that people are overconscious of that, or is that exactly what we should be doing, you know, looking at different aspects of our life?
I mean, people do have a habit, not in my everyday life, but when I travel places, people who don't, you know, I'm not quite as earnest and sincere as people think I am. I'm sincere about my mission in life, but I always say, if we can't joke around, what's the point of saving the planet? You know, but so people do that. They're like, oh, you know, they'll come up to me in a plastic cup, and I'm always like, well, say 10 Hail Marys. the question is, again, not everybody is going to be No Impact Man, and nor should everybody be No Impact Man. I think of this a lot. Like, if we all run off and care for the environment, who's going to be at home taking care of the orphans, right? Actually, what we, you know, and I say this too, like, I'm not on a campaign to make everybody like me. I'm actually on a campaign to make everybody, you know, what I'm asking when I sit before an audience is that you be like you, but more like you. Because I believe that each of us has within us, you know, an innate wisdom and innate compassion and ideas for ourselves about how we in particular want to help the world. And I think that as people, we get great satisfaction if we are able to help the world in the way that we want to help the world. and yet something about the system in which we live forces us to make so many compromises along the way that we're not actually following our own personal missions. So you know, I don't care whether you're, you know, I was going to say, I don't care if you have a plastic coffee cup. I guess I don't, but I would prefer that we move away from bottled water. And I'll just say that bottled water is stupid. Sometimes actually, you know, when I get interviewed, people say, what do you think about bottled water? I used to come up with this whole, like, you know, the privatization of water, and if we support private water, then the municipal water won't have support, and before you know it, remember the spike in gas prices a few years, that will happen to water, right? So we shouldn't drink bottled water. And finally, people, these days when people say, plus the culture's changed, so you can say this a little bit, so people say, what do you think about bottled water? I just say, it's stupid, you know? but my point here is, like, don't sweat whether you're doing everything right. Sweat the big stuff. Sweat the direction of your life. Like, is your life in line with your values? You know? And if it's not, it doesn't mean that you have, it doesn't mean, you know, actually this whole question of saying Hail Marys or the different forms of penance that we have in our religions, they are not about whipping ourselves. They are about actually, you know, the repetition is it's actually about bringing us back to mindfulness. To actually give us, it's an exercise in mindfulness, you know, and in every, you know, in Buddhism they have a bowing practice where you bow for, where you do prostrations for penance. And it's not about hurting yourself, it's about doing something that brings you back to the moment. And then once you're back in the moment, you can actually ask yourself, who am I in this situation? What's the way I want to react in this situation?
Author Colin Bevan was the featured speaker at the Fayetteville Public Library's 8th Annual Gathering of the Groups earlier this fall.
Earth, Sky.
Thursday, November 24th. The best views of the fourth and final solar eclipse of 2011 will be a deep partial eclipse of the midnight sun as seen from Antarctica.
Right now, there's 24 hours of sunlight falling on Earth's southernmost continent. If you were in the right spot in Antarctica today, you'd be able to witness this spectacular eclipse of the midnight sun, with nearly 90% of the sun's disk covered over by the new moon.
Outside of Antarctica, a much shallower partial solar eclipse will be visible on Friday, November 25th, from southwestern South Africa, Tasmania, and most of New Zealand.
Switching now to a whole Earth perspective, the whole eclipse lasts for nearly 4 hours. It starts at sunrise over the South Atlantic Ocean, sweeps eastward across Antarctica, then ends at sunset over New Zealand. Outside of Antarctica, this partial eclipse is visible mostly from the ocean, but some people on land will see it. We have eclipse times at earthsky.org.
If you're lucky enough to see this partial eclipse, we remind you that it's essential to protect your eyes. Come to earthsky.org for eye safety tips and the precise eclipse times for the partial solar eclipse in your sky. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums, and with me on the phone from his office in Fort Smith is Michael Tilley. He's the editor and publisher, president of the City Wire, more about that in a moment, that covers business, politics, culture, and more in the Fort Smith region. And a full disclaimer that even though you're hearing us talk on Thanksgiving, we talked the day before, no sense in ruining Michael's Thanksgiving Day plans. How are you, sir?
I'm well. Not that my plans are that elaborate, but yeah, I appreciate the thinking of me.
And I offer that disclaimer because the first thing we talk about are some employment numbers that really came to you just before we began our conversation on Wednesday.
Correct. The state of Arkansas released their unemployment data. Apparently, in October, the unemployment rate dropped to 8.2% from 8.3% in September. So that's the right direction, but as you said, these just popped in the box, so I haven't had time to look to see. Sometimes when the unemployment rate drops, or even when it increases, it doesn't necessarily reflect a change in the number of people who are employed or unemployed. The factor that goes into that is also the civilian labor force count, and unfortunately, one of the things we've seen in the last couple of years is that more and more people are just dropping out of that count. They're either just going creating their own company, their own job, or they're just not reporting any longer. And I think a lot of times people will say, well, the real unemployment rate is closer to 15 or 20%, depending on what part of the world you live in. And that factors in for that. But right now, it looks like hopefully going in the lower direction is a good sign for Arkansas.
Well, we'll know more about that later. What we're also going to have to wait a while to know more about is the Ben Garin Regional Park.
The Fort Smith Board of Directors and the Sachem County Quorum Court met. They met Monday night with the hopes, anyway, of coming to an agreement on sharing the park. It's a very large park. In fact, the only other larger park in terms of acreage is there in North Little Rock. And I just was talking about it this morning, and for some reason the name escapes me. Burns Park in North Little Rock. But they were going to talk about the board of directors and the quorum court were to talk about an aquatic facility, ball fields, softball fields, sharing the cost of those, the upfront cost, the maintenance cost, ongoing maintenance costs, the annexation that would be involved. It's a fairly complex agreement. It's a lengthy draft. Kyle, the sense is most of the members of both bodies like the plan. But the quorum court members wanted to see the 2012 budget before they agreed to anything, and that budget discussion has not yet happened with the quorum court. So it looks like early December, around December 12th, December 13th, we may have an agreement on what has essentially been a three-year, maybe not quite that long, but almost a three-year process.
So this slight delay should not indicate any loss of enthusiasm on anyone's part.
Well, we hope not. You know, the concern among many, and I, not that it was concern with me, I was just more curious about it, was after the prepared food tax was so overwhelmingly defeated, I was curious to see if the Fort Smith Board of Directors would, because we have some members of the board who test the political winds before they make a decision, and I thought that maybe some of them would get cold feet on it. But it didn't appear to be the case last night.
There is going to be perhaps a hardwood tree museum at Chaffee Crossing. I'm not sure what that is.
Well, I grew up on a farm, so I think I grew up in a hardwood tree museum because they were all over the place. And sometimes we converted certain wings of our hardwood tree museum into firewood.
Fuel. Yeah. Always,
I don't think they'll be doing that with this one. But, yes, seriously, the hardwood tree museum, it reflects essentially, or at least it's their plan to reflect the various economies that have built up around the hardwood tree, all of the things that have been used to all of the items constructed with wood over the years in Arkansas. You know, essentially our economy, especially that in Fort Smith area, was built upon wood manufacturing. And one of the gentlemen with the association, Bob Worley, said that a lot of the, and he thinks most of them, but he's not sure of, but a lot of the Army rifles used to train the troops early on at Camp Chaffee during World War II, they were just solid wood, but they mimicked the weight and the feel of a rifle. And they were made here in Fort Smith for, you know, literally hundreds of thousands of troops who came through. So that's an interesting thing I never thought of. But they hope to get this thing going. They're sensitive about not competing with the Marshall's Museum in terms of dollars and attention. But they did want to get the word out because they're discovering that some people will say, yeah, I used to have such and such artifact related to the wood industry, but I threw that out. Mm. So they're trying to get the word out to capture as many artifacts as possible.
Finally, things must be going well at the City Wire, a web news source that 5 years ago many of us didn't know about web news sources or give them much chance to compete, but you're expanding.
Yes, we are, and you're correct. You know, 3 years ago we launched the City Wire, relaunched it in November 2008. And at that time people would say, look, you know, you guys have a good idea and good plan. You just can't make money on the internet. Good luck, guys. Well, we have made money, and we've proven that our model works. And we were able to secure some investors, a gentleman named Chester Kaprovic and Benny Westfall, who believed in our model. And these gentlemen operate in a wide range of industries, from high tech to energy to machine shop, and they like what we're doing. They've watched what we're doing for 3 years, and they're going to help us expand. We've hired a couple of folks, Daylene Brown and Debbie Foliart, to help us do that. We're going to probably announce in the next couple of months some other writers, some other new hires. But we're moving forward and hope to help you provide even more news, business, and political coverage there in Northwest Arkansas in the near future.
One of the investors that you quote in your story about the expansion says that he thinks newspapers in the future will be a thing of the past. You're an old newspaper guy. Do you think that's the case?
I I have you've hit a very sensitive issue with me. I am an old newspaper guy, and I'm a web guy too, obviously. But I still have some old, you know, I'm still somewhat sentimental about the newspapers. Now I can tell you, I haven't had a newspaper delivered to my house in a long time, and it's just a function of necessity. I can get the news online. That's what I do, and I'm online most of the day. Now, my wife, we do like to get the Sunday paper and go through it, but more and more we've discovered that doesn't take very long to go through the Sunday paper, where it used to be, you know, the better part of a Sunday morning. But, yes, the short answer to your question, I think he's correct. I don't think it'll be in the next 2 to 3 years, but I don't think they're going to go away entirely. I think there'll be specialty publications for many years to come, and in some of the larger communities they may have a paper once a week or a paper on Sunday, but... with the iPad, with other readers, it's just, you know, and it's not just newspapers, Kyle. It's forcing us at the CityWire to reconsider how we deliver the news. It's not just a browser platform anymore that we have to be focused on. You know, you look at the rise in the number of people who receive their news through mobile devices, and the question is not always necessarily, well, is the newspaper platform obsolete, but what do we do about the browser platform?
You know, it's interesting. At my household, we still have papers delivered to the house. I read the paper version. My wife subscribes to the papers on her iPad and will read them on her iPad through the day.
Well,
she's also 9 years younger than me, so maybe we found the split of where it happens.
I think that you're not an isolated case.
Well, I hope you have a great Thanksgiving. And
well, thank you. You as well.
And now I refer to you as the president of the City Wire. Is that right?
Well, yeah. You know, that's just the title. I still have to keep my head down and work hard.
Okay.
They didn't give me a fancy office or anything like that. Nobody plays hail to the chief when I walk in.
Well, Michael Tilley is the president of the City Wire, and although he likes it better the way Ithi Agnihotri-Madolkar says it, I'll say this. The City Wire covers business, politics. I listened last week. Business, politics, and culture, and more for the Fort Smith region. Michael, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, Kyle.
It's Thanksgiving Thursday, November 24, 2011. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Ithi Agnihotri-Madolkar, and with me in the studio is Becca Bacon-Martin, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Actually, the truth is we were in the studio when we taped this because we're really at home eating like everybody else. But we do have some things that you can plan ahead on.
But
events
I'm really
that are going
here.
On. You're really here?
I'm really here, but you're not.
I'm not really here.
We're messing with your minds now.
Wow, now I'm confused. Okay, I'm going to tell you about some things that are really going to happen in the area.
Okay.
Bob Seger is on tour. He will perform December 9th in St. Louis, December 10th in Memphis, and December 17th in Dallas.
Okay.
You can visit bobseger.com to find out details. Other music going on in the area, Kid Rock... Mm-hmm. On November 29th at the Midland by AMC in Kansas City.
Mm-hmm.
Also on November 29th, Kanye West and Jay-Z at the Sprint Center in Kansas City.
I like their new album.
December 2nd, Kenny Rogers is going to be at the Hard Rock Casino in Tulsa.
Okay.
December 4th, Rise Against is going to be at the Brady Theater in Tulsa.
Mm-hmm.
December 6th, My Morning Jacket, one of our music writer Kevin Kinder's favorite bands, is at the Brady Theater in Tulsa. December 9th, the Trans-Siberian Orchestra is at the Verizon Arena in Little Rock. And on December 11th, the Trans-Siberian Orchestra is at American Airlines Center in Dallas. And for those of you who care, you're probably not listening to KUAF, but you might be. Rammstein is coming to the United States. They'll be at the American Airlines Center in Dallas in May. Take me with you.
Don't be alarmed, listeners. This is just Becca, very, very excited. Thanks,
Becca. Happy Thanksgiving,
Becca.
Ithi.
Same to you, Becca. Becca Bacon-Martin is the features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Iti Agnihotri Matholkar.
Thanksgiving is a holiday when many families try to get together to celebrate. Author Bill Walker is able to celebrate his family once again in a most unusual way. Bill Walker wrote the new book, Nazi's Nightmare. It's a day-by-day account of his father George Walker's time in World War II, a story that Bill didn't know while his father was alive. The book takes a look at United States military intelligence organizations and operations of the time. Earlier this month, we ran part of that conversation on Ozarks at Large. We enjoyed the story so much and the visit with Bill Walker so much that we wanted to air more of that conversation on this Thanksgiving Day edition of Ozarks at Large when so many families are together.
None.
I knew a handful of stories that Dad had told, and we knew he was in something to do with intelligence, or we suspected that. But basically, when I asked him what he did in the Army in World War II, he said, well, when we liberate an area, I would go in and try to put in some semblance of order.
And that's all how he would describe it.
That was all he ever said.
So in the book, Nazi's Nightmare, we learn that he did a lot more. When did you first find out about his career?
I was rummaging through my mother's dusty, dank 16, 18-year-old storage room that everybody had pilfered through before to see if there was anything that I might want to keep. And fortunately, there was a box of cordials and spirits that had every bug in the place in it that I didn't want to keep, and I found this other box that had all these papers and two scrapbooks and baby book, and then I found the military training materials. Oh, my God. It was just that's all they were. It was his classes as a CIC special agent trainee, and that was May 16th of 6 years ago.
I can't imagine what you must have been – every page that you turned, every letter that you looked at, you must have been uncovering more.
I immediately packed up that box that had Counterintelligence Corps scrapbook, high school, college stuff, and all these letters to and from he and some other special agents and to his parents from him and maybe a sister or two, and all these photographs and the military training documents. And I immediately packed it up and took straight back off to Fayetteville and put it out on the table and stayed up all night.
How did you make sense? Was it, I mean, of course, in the book, you present it with your father's words in chronological order. First, he goes to Camp Robinson, then Fort Leonard Ward, and moves on as his career in intelligence and eventually takes him across the ocean. What was it like when you found it?
It was overwhelming. What was it? What did it really have in it? This is military stuff. A daily journal of every day of the war with the mission of the invasion of Normandy and how the security was put together on it and what they accomplished. I mean, oh my, what's in here? Arrest reports of Nazis. I just decided the first thing I needed to go find someone to help me make copies of it and go see somebody that might would just take it over and take care of it and write books. And I went straight to Larry Malley at University Press, and he said, well, you don't have a book. I went to Greg Mack and said, hey, man, look at this stuff. Help me. He said, well, you don't have a book.
And I told Bill, I said, this is all fine and dandy, but somebody's got to write this.
Yeah.
And so actually Larry Malley said, well, you need to go see Tom Dillard. And that's where I got my direction and my focus and what could really happen.
Tom is the head of special collections at the university.
Right, yeah. Right. And he said we would love to have these papers, but it'll take us a while. We're working on some very major projects 6 years ago, and it would be a while before we get to it. So I said, well, why don't I just take them and make me a copy, and then I'll bring them back. So I made a hard copy because I didn't want to scan them yet, and brought him back the originals in 2008 and all the papers and signed them off to him. And then they were kind enough to let me take them back out to do the scanning part. I didn't think of how to do this book until a year ago, October 1st, exactly this book.
Was Greg helpful in that respect?
Greg was extremely helpful. He says, go get you a book and I'll help you promote it.
Well, I mean, basically, I Bill mean, had an epiphany that he didn't have to write a book. He just had to organize it.
Right. And that was a year ago. And I had that hard copy, so I went back to the original hard copies. I'd been scanning for a year, and I'd been trying to write historical fiction for three, and it didn't work. So I finished a couple other projects and put it all aside and thought, well, I will do the replication part because they can't get to that either. And I just started scanning, and about other than keeping my income, mm-hmm. I mean, John Lewis told me right off the bat, don't forget to make a living while you're working on your hobby. Mm-hmm. So it took a year to scan all that stuff, and I woke up October 1st last year and thought, I know how to do this. And it took exactly a year to the day to send it off to the publisher.
There's a nice part of the book when he alerts family members to a Look magazine article, you know, that says Heroes Without Medals. And I love that he writes, you might want to buy a couple, three of these to send out.
I found that magazine in an old magazine, used magazine treasure trove of a bookstore in Portland.
Really? Yeah, you right, found the actual?
Yeah, I went down to this place where they've got all these magazines, and I dug through all of his Look, and he had a March 7th, 1944 Look magazine. And I dug out that article, you know, and it's got the captions and the photographs. But that's the only photographed and written public, other than one article that's in the American called G-Men in Khaki, that I know that was ever written back then about them. And that was the early part of the war in Sicily.
After spending 6.5 years with this story and rereading and cataloging and then thinking about your dad, does it seem not so much a surprise now for you? I mean, when you put all the pieces together?
Oh, it doesn't seem a surprise at all. I went to see Is It Where Eagles Dare? And James Mason is in this very stately-looking German house, all fooling them, looking like a kraut. And my dad didn't remind me of him. He reminded me of my dad.
James Mason reminded you, yeah.
And I never knew, but that was the most, just gut feeling, kind of. You knew he was something.
Have you talked to anybody who might have been a friend, colleague, contemporary of your dad?
Well, lots of people, but not a whole lot about this. You asked if I was concerned earlier, and I kept this way under wraps. I mean, I told a whole lot of people about what my task was, but I didn't share a whole lot of all of this anywhere. I didn't even scan it till 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't know what I had. And I have friends. I've met U.S. Marshals. I've met – it's in the – you know, I've mentioned in the book that I met a whole lot of people who are in this business. And their first response to me was, you've got a lot of work to do. Get it done. I want to buy a copy. Hmm. And a real good friend of mine I went to high school with, and the FBI's proofread everything I've got. And, you know, it doesn't teach you how to blow up anything or doesn't put the FBI fingerprint version in there. But you know, you just kind of had this feeling about Dad all the time that he was the lawyer's lawyer. And he had a photographic memory in my mind. I asked him if he'd ever read The Rime of the Ancient Mariner when he was 62, and I was 16, and I was having a little difficulty with it. And he said, wait a minute. And you could just watch the wheels rolling around. He said, oh, I read it in high school when I was 16 and then started quoting it from page one, paragraph one, word one. And I went, oh, well, nice, isn't it? I think I'm going to go back and read it again.
So you can completely understand what the military saw in him.
Oh, absolutely. That letter from the Supreme Court Justice that recommends him for the second level of intelligence, it's all recognizable. He was the lawyer's lawyer. Glenn Lovett went in one day and said, I worked on this and worked on this and worked on this, and I know there's a precedent, but I just can't find it. He says, oh, well, I wrote that law, and it's in volume so-and-so, page so-and-so, paragraph, section point two or whatever. And you just went, wow. Anything he ever said, I don't think he ever misspoke a word he didn't intend on saying out loud.
Greg, I want to bring you back into this conversation. When Bill first came to you, he said, well, you don't have a book. You have the startings of a book. But based on the previous conversations you and I have had, you knew there was something here, didn't you?
Yeah, just from the Bill's level of excitement. And I've known Bill a long time, and I knew he wouldn't make anything up. And you know there's bound to be lots of stories out there, but just a little bit he was telling me about it, it just sounded more and more fascinating, because that was, I guess as Tom Brokaw coined the phrase, America's greatest generation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, movies like Saving Private Ryan and the Band of Brothers. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just love that stuff, because these were kind of ordinary people that were thrust in this world war, and they were doing this on the fly. So you know that it wasn't like they had an intelligence department before that. So it makes, you know, if they find this guy, it doesn't matter he's from Jonesboro, Arkansas.
Helena.
What matters is he's brilliant and he can do this. And you know they were it's like Tom Hanks playing the character that was a school teacher. Because they say, like, you know, at D-Day, that wasn't won by planning or anything else. It was won by individual men doing individual heroic things. So that's the basis of this whole thing. Because you know that they had, once they realized the German war machine, it's like, we're behind, and we've got to get caught up in a hurry. Mm-hmm. Because, like you said, they were already had spies in our country when half the people wanted to stay out of the war.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's so many fascinating side stories in there about the dinner with De Gaulle.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was one he actually told. That was one he actually told. He said, you know, when we liberated France, Brittany, De Gaulle was repatriated, and I was actually second in command on the continent in intelligence. And De Gaulle, for a luncheon in Saint-Brieuc, brought all of his military leaders together, and he invited the Allied's counterparts. So Dad's boss didn't want to go because he didn't speak French. And Dad's story on it was, well, the joke was on him because my French intelligence counterpart went to school at Oxford and spoke better English than I. You know, so you know, you always got a kick out of that. And I had the menu. I mean, I found the menu. I mean, oh, my God. We're going to do a dinner at a couple of places. The Capitol Hotel and Bordino's have both agreed that they'd love to do a replication of the De Gaulle Comes Back to France dinner.
Oh,
it's about
wow.
Six courses, and I think they're drinking Muscadet and Bordeaux with dinner. But before that, he describes that that he's going to have dinner with some regular Army big shots because their boss is coming to town. And he says he stumbles home the next day about 4:30, and the luncheon started at 11. And then no wonder the French lost the war, but boy, can they set a table.
All of this, of course, you go back to finding that box the first time, it's all a surprise. Was there any one thing that most surprised you in all
of this?
I think
the one thing that most surprised me is the three pieces of evidence, and I don't have one clue as to what can be done with it. I've talked to DNA places, but I put it at the start of the part of the book where they're talking about lessons learned, and it gets the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a photograph in there of a little jewelry box from Edinburgh, Scotland, with a spent bullet in it that I believe has still to this day some bone material on it. And then there's a photograph right next to it of my father standing in a grave with a pistol in his hand, smiling, and it has a tack hole in it. And then there's another photograph from another angle that came in a different letter that has him throwing a football over that building from a different angle, as if in my information to say it would be that building. I think it's in Verdun. But I don't know who got it in Verdun, but I believe I have the bullet and the photograph and the description of how you keep evidence and stuff and why you'd keep it that makes you wonder,
what happened?
Who had that last?
Yeah.
But I know it's not one that whizzed by his head and went into a wall, the one that missed him. I know that's not the case.
But well, there were some pretty big names that he tracked down, too.
There's some notes in there that changed the history of the disposition of one Hermann Goering at the point of arrest by the American troops. And you'll also, if you piece it all together, it says, we caught on the 17th of April, the entry is, we caught the biggest guy we've ever caught. And on the 16th of April is when Hermann Goering was caught. And they talk about who got what from whom, like Air Corps and this brought the Standartfuhrer back. And then there's a handwritten note about Fuhrer Hermann attempts suicide and does some nasty things. And that stuff's just not in the history books. Mm. And there's a collaborating piece of evidence in the Daily Journal, the Military Daily Journal, for on this. The second part I talked about was May 28th. In the Military Journal, May 28th, it says, Lieutenant Walker and the English captain work on the
American that was a big shot in the Goring Works. Looks as if a case of treason. I'd like to know who that guy was. Mm. I think he's probably the fellow that helped folks understand industry and banking and who had what money and where in the world market, because they were very, very, very capable at stealing every bit of money they could ever find anywhere in any world, in any market they ever entered into.
And one last thought. It shows that, you know, you can grow up with someone, you can love someone, you can spend a lot of time with them. You never know the full story, do you?
No, but I never felt worried about when I was around him.
I bet not.
You know, it's been my experience that some of the people that experience the most talk the least. It's that they feel like they've lived it, and they don't. I mean, I know a lot of Vietnam vets were like that, you know. Mm-hmm. The ones that were really in the action, they don't even want to talk about it.
These guys just want to get the job done, come home, go bird hunting,
right,
and get on with their lives and marry their girlfriends and have babies.
And the quicker the better.
And live, it's a lot better being the conqueror than the conquered. I mean, things roll along pretty well. Mm-hmm. I think we're seeing the end of that generation, and we're rolling into a new phase of the world right now. And there's lots of things you can apply in this book that you can draw your own conclusions on about what's going on, and I think they're very helpful to anyone.
Congratulations on a great achievement.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday. It's the 24th of November, 2011. It is Thanksgiving Day, a day that we trace back to 1621, when the Pilgrims sat down with the tribe of Wampanoag Indians, though it wasn't until 1789 that George Washington proclaimed a day of national Thanksgiving and prayer in November. The holiday fell out of custom, though, and by the mid-19th century, only a handful of states officially celebrated Thanksgiving. It was Sarah Josepha Hale who wrote the poem Mary Had a Little Lamb, and who was an editor of a women's magazine who campaigned for Thanksgiving for 36 years, wrote to four presidents about it, Taylor, Fillmore, Pierce, and Buchanan. And then she wrote to Abraham Lincoln, and he declared the last Thursday of November a day of thanksgiving and praise. It was Ralph Waldo Emerson who said, "Cultivate the habit of being grateful for every good thing that comes to you and to give thanks continuously, and because all things have contributed to your advancement, you should include all things in your gratitude." Here's a poem for today by Linda McCarriston entitled Thanksgiving. Every year we call it down upon ourselves, the chaos of the day before the occasion, the morning before the meal. Outdoors, the men cut wood, fueling appetite in the gray air as Nana, Arlene, Mary, Robin, whatever women we amount to, turn loose from their wrappers the raw, unmade ingredients. A flour sack leaks. Potatoes wobble down countertops, tracking dirt like kids. Blue Hubbard erupts into shards and sticky pulp when it's whacked with the big knife. Cranberries leap away rather than be halved. And the bird, poor blue thing, only we see it in its dead skin, gives up for good the long, obscene neck, the gizzard, the liver, quivering in my hand, the heart. So what? What of it? Besides the laughter, I mean, or the steam that shades the windows so that the youngest sons must come inside to see how the smells look, besides the piled wood closing over the porch windows, the pipes the men fill, the beers they crack, waiting in front of the game. Any deliberate leap into chaos, small or large, with intent to make order, matters. That's what. A whole day has passed between the first apple cored for pie and the last glass polished and set down. This is a feast we know how to make, a day of feast, a day of thanksgiving, for all we have and all we are, and whatever we've learned to do with it. Dear God, we thank you for your gifts in this kitchen, the fire, the food, the wine, that we are together here. Bless the world that swirls outside these windows, a room full of gifts, seeming raw and disordered, a great room in which the stoves are cold, the food scattered, the children locked forever outside dark windows. Dear God, grant to the makers and keepers power to save it all. Thanksgiving, a poem by Linda McCarriston from Talking Soft Dutch, published by Texas Tech Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, you can read the current issue of Poetry or listen to the monthly editor's podcast at poetryfoundation.org. Produced by Kathy Roach and Nick Vedder, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
KUAF is supported by Ella's Restaurant, located at the Inn at Carnell Hall on the University of Arkansas campus. Ella's offers a variety of fine dining experiences during breakfast, lunch, dinner, and weekend brunch. An Indian lunch buffet is served each Tuesday. Menus, event schedules, and more information available at ellasrestaurant.com.
And the KUAF and Friends Holiday Giveaway will be held Thursday, December 15th, during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large. The drawing is your chance to win a gift from one of many KUAF underwriters and program sponsors. Participants this year include Opera in the Ozarks, Arcega's Espresso Cafes, Deborah Dubois Massage Therapist, and Newton's Jewelers. Registration and more information available on the web at KUAF.com.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Springdale, Rogers, Bentonville, the whole of Northwest Arkansas family and our entire listening area.
Sure. It's Thanksgiving.
That's our family.
That's right. Your family, much of your family, still in Lucknow. Right?
You are fascinated by that name.
I am. Your hometown is Lucknow, India.
Yes.
L-U-C-K-N-O-W.
Yes. Lucknow.
That's perhaps the greatest town city name I've ever heard. Obviously, you did not have Thanksgiving as...
No, we did not. We celebrated Christmas and Easter, but never Thanksgiving.
Well, that is a uniquely American... I know there's Canadian Thanksgiving. Was there any sort of holiday that was the equivalent where family would get together and it was...
Pretty much all. What about you? What traditions do you guys follow?
Well, Laura, my wife's family, very traditional Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. Turkey, candied yams, the whole nine yards. Growing up, my mother would like to try something different every Thanksgiving. So we might have ham one year.
Okay.
I think we had venison one year. I think we did a vegetarian Thanksgiving one year. She always liked to try something different.
That's interesting.
It was very interesting. Same woman who one year in my lifetime kept the Christmas tree up year-round but decorated it for different holidays. So you might have had
That's a great idea.
She was a kindergarten teacher. So that gives you some insight.
Kyle's mom.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Iti Agnihotri Matholkar.
We'll be back together Sunday morning
mm-hmm.
for weekend Ozarks at Large, Sunday morning at 9. Have a great Turkey Day.